bit from the introduction to his book, because he says he's really talking about more than just music in this book. He says there is something missing in Black America, and symptoms of the illness are in its music. But I don't want this book to be just a eulogy. If one idea could be said to inspire the death of rhythm and blues, it is, you can tell where Black people are at any given point in history by our music. He says, I've heard Black people say this countless times, but my beef was that they never really thought about the state of Blacks. They were just spouting a nice piece of rhetoric. He says, I took the rhetoric to heart. Thinking about the present and the future, I went looking through the past, and the death of rhythm and blues is what I found. This book is published by Pantheon. Nelson George is also the author of two other books, The Michael Jackson Story, and also Where Did Our Love Go, which is a history of Motown. Mr. George, hello.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, thanks. To start out, both to make sure that people understand what qualifies as R&B, what kind of music we're talking about, we probably ought to have a definition. And two, because as you say, as you start out telling your story, that you're not just talking about music. So what is R&B?
Well, in a technical way, I would say that rhythm and blues is post-World War II Black popular music. In that sense, it takes in a lot of different forms. I think that that takes in the many great doo-wop groups of the 50s. It describes a lot of the urban bluesmen from Chicago, people like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, who recorded for Chess Records, could also be considered part of the rhythm and blues. Southern soul music is epitomized by people like Otis Redding, and later, Wilson Pickett, etc., on through funk music, which we sort of identify with people like James Brown, Sly, the Howl Players, Kool & the Gang. Disco music from the 70s on through rap music up through people like Whitney Houston and Anita Baker. So rhythm and blues has sort of been a phrase that has been used to characterize or to categorize, I guess that's the best way, a large segment of non-jazz Black popular music. The music that we dance to, the music that we party to and hum, I guess you might say.
Well, that covers an awful wide range of styles of music. I mean, that's an awful lot of territory if you look at all of those various artists and
but the, all the thing about it that they're connected is two things that connect them. One is a matter of continuity and tradition. Each step along the way was influenced by what came before. Mm-hmm. So it's very much an evolutionary line. And two, it's a matter of that the mechanisms for promoting and marketing these musics have been pretty consistent. I deal a great at length in the book about Black radio in America, about retail stores located in Black communities, mom-and-pop record stores, they call them, and also deal extensively with Black concert venues, things like the Apollo Theater or the Regal, which used to be in Chicago, which they're trying to bring back in some form now. So while the root of the music has always been the same, the venues and the vehicles for exposing this music have also always been the same, or have consistently been the same. One of the things I talk about in the book at length is the idea that a lot of these institutions which have helped shape and promote this music are either dead or in serious decline, and that in the change that's going on and how Black music is promoted, it's had a very profound and I think a very negative effect on the music itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about, as I said, you make this point that the book is not just about music. What is that other thing that you're trying to get at?
I think that the music and the world of music is very much a reflection of the world of Black struggle in America in general. For example, let's take the contemporary state. Okay, the two dominant directions, okay, in Black music are the crossover idea and rap music. Mm-hmm. The crossover idea very much represents, in music, a parallel to the world of going on in politics. We have Black mayors. We have black congressmen, we have black people running for governor. We have people like Jesse Jackson, William Gray in Philadelphia, the congressman who's very powerful in Congress. We're having black figures become important figures, not just for black America, but for all Americans. In the same way that we have Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson and people like that, who are considered not even black stars anymore, damn near, but really considered just superstars, okay? So we have this phenomenon of many, many blacks achieving at a high, high level of American society. At the same time, we have rap music, which is something that is very much a music of the black underclass, if we're going to use that term. It's the music of poor blacks, urban blacks, the black youth, the group which is probably the most discriminated against, misunderstood, and ill-educated group in this country. And their music is a reflection of all that's good and bad about their lifestyles. And so their music speaks very much to their concerns and to their world. So, and if you compare the world of a Whitney Houston to the world of Run DMC or Kool Moe Dee, any rapper, they don't seem to be parallel worlds. I mean, the way they look, the way they express themselves, the sound of their music suggests these different dynamics, and very extreme dynamics with very little common ground, seemingly. And I think that that's where the music comes in a contemporary sense. That's what I'm talking about, how music reflects these different conditions.
Yeah. I think there, some people might say there's two ways of looking at this. You might say on the one hand that the black performers who have really made it in the white world, or at least secured large parts of the white audience, one might look at that and say, well, these people have been co-opted, that they've sold out, that they have lost what really made them special. They have lost their roots. And somebody else might say, well, but, you know, look at those past performers, black performers, that maybe were true to themselves and their roots, and where did it get them? And, you know, so one might say, well, why begrudge Whitney Houston her success?
Well, see, my point is not, I think it's possible. I think we can cite, as I do in the book, many examples of black performers who have maintained a very much an edge, a black creative edge, and been very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, to me, that's the model for, in terms of the musical model, what I'd like to see. Someone like Sly Stone was incredibly creative, incredibly black-based in his vocal arrangements, which was gospel, the rhythm arrangements, which were R&B and funk, and yet he also was a great, just pure pop songwriter. He managed to take all of these different elements and fuse them together. I think that someone like Prince is very brilliant, has been very brilliant in doing the same things, and using everything that influenced him in his music, but without making it into mush. I mean, my biggest problem with American music in general, and with black contemporary music in particular, is a certain sameness, a certain lack of willingness to be aggressively on the edge, to be progressive. I mean, I think what's happening right now is that we're in an era of Memorex music,
mm-hmm.
where people tend to either try and take very safe road by making very mushy ballads, or making dance records which sound very much like the last dance record you heard, and sort of fade into like a big mix that could be anyone, like interchangeable parts. I think it's a very, very negative thing that's happening in American music, and I think it's particularly devastating to black music, because black music has traditionally been an engine for innovation in American music. I mean, rap music, for example, which is, I think is a very hotly debated topic, but undeniably is a different sound than has been going on in American music, is one that's very innovative, and they take chances, they sample from different sounds, they use different kind of rhythmic ideas, they deal with very different subject matter. And I think that they've been a very exciting addition to American music, precisely because they've been outsiders, precisely because they've tried to push the barriers of what constitutes music. Mm-hmm. And I think black music has always been. I mean, when soul music first came to the fore, it was not. It was definitely a departure even from what traditional rhythm and blues had been. It was much more overtly gospel-y. It was much more, and the many blacks had problems with it because it had such a gospel feel. We could cite time and time again where blacks have pushed open the doors and have tried to move things ahead. I think one of the factors in why we've reached an era of some complacency is the idea that the way to success is the way of basically catering to the lowest common denominator. And I think that's very very dangerous for us culturally. And someone who has an amnesia about who they are is someone eventually who loses a lot of their purpose and loses a lot of the things that made them special.
Yeah, I wonder how much you think of this is a result of what performers want, and how much has to do with the business people that drive the business. You know, promoters and record producers and agents and all those kind of people who stand on the other side of the lights.
Well, it's a self-perpetuating cycle. I think artists come into it initially wanting to make music or wanting to be, and also a lot of them want to be just stars. A lot of them will say, I don't care what it takes to do that. Others will say, I want to do this because I have a certain thing I want to express. What tended to happen is the people who tend to be more artistically based, who feel they just want to express their music, tend to be the ones who will try and be a little bit more rebellious. Those who are just in it for the money will do anything and record anything for that reason. I mean, but again, okay, I'm not saying in the book that record industry is not about money. It's a capitalistic system. It's about taking something that we like, giving it to us in a package that we can enjoy. My beef is how it's done and the mentality that's behind it. I think that we can do these things without really being pandering and without just making bland, boring music. I think that someone like Anita Baker to me is a great heroine, because she has managed to succeed with a wide audience of Americans by singing a music which is very much a synthesis of some of our best styles of gospel, blues, jazz. When you hear Anita Baker, you seem to hear all of that in her singing. I think that's very important. I think it's healthy. I think it shows people that you don't have to be a cookie cutter. You don't have to sound like the record that came before. And I think in black music that's particularly encouraging because, as I said before, I feel there's been a certain Memorex quality to a lot of the music, especially, I would say, in the last 15 years. And it stifled a lot of creativity.
We're talking this morning with Nelson George, who's written a book entitled The Death of Rhythm and Blues. He writes about music for a Billboard magazine. And I have a caller here who's been hanging on for a bit, and we'd like to involve other people in the discussion. You've got your own, you folks listening have your own opinions, or you have some questions for our guest. Just pick up your telephone and you can be a part of the show. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here's somebody on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have an opinion or a comment regarding this, and I would say that from my own observation that the music that came out of the black culture before the civil rights laws were passed was sad, because the people were sad, all right, but the white people love that music because they too were sad. And it did something to express their and to expiate their sadness. And I think that that is a point that really appears to me to be the way it was. Now I see that that we don't have so much of that the blues singing anymore, because this has all been corrected, you know. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I would disagree with you that the black music made before was sad. I would say that, well, people tend to say the blues were sad because a lot of the themes or subject matter of blues were about hard times, and some of it was sad, but I would disagree that most of it was sad. I would say that blues is also a party music. Blues is also music that people had a good time to, that had house parties to. Just as I wouldn't say that all of Count Basie or Duke Ellington's music, which was pre-civil rights, you know, era music was sad. But I would agree with you that the ability of black music to appeal to everyone without having, by being true to the experience of the people who made it, is something that I'm very much an advocate of. And I think that the best music that we've made, I think that the stuff that Aretha Franklin, for example, did, which is some of the best music ever made, I think, in this country, some of her singing, was so imposing and so powerful because it captured such a wide range of experience. There was joy, sadness, all of those things. I don't think singers today are even given the leeway in terms of how their material is selected or how their material is produced to deliver that kind of emotional impact. You know, I think there's singers out there who still can do that, but you don't hear it on the record very often. Mm. So I would just disagree about the idea that it was all sad, but I would agree with you that by expressing what they felt, black artists will manage to express what everyone felt.
I wonder if you think that that white audiences listening to black music were listening for the same reasons, or they were hearing the same things in the music.
Well, I mean, that's always an interesting question, and it's hard to jump into people's heads. I think, for example, let's take Motown. I wrote a book about Motown. Motown's an interesting example. I think there's a certain buoyancy, a certain sense of optimism that Motown, in its mid-60s heyday, projected, which mirrored a lot of the optimism that was going on in the country about social change, about political change. It really mirrored that very well, and I think that the sound of Young America was a very shrewd choice of name because they were able to appeal to everyone with their music. So I think that in that case, I think there was a certain a community of spirit about what the music's about. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Let's say when people hear rap music or people hear blues. I think that a lot of black people today, for very silly reasons, think that blues is a music of sadness or being Uncle Tom, for that matter, or some kind of corny legacy that they don't want to ignore. I think that's terrible. But I think that a lot of more whites seem to have a much more deep affection for it, at least younger whites, than a lot of their younger black counterparts. So I think it depends on the style of music. And it depends on the particular historical, context. Another good example is reggae. Reggae was really embraced by white Americans, young white Americans, at a time when black Americans paid little attention to it and had little interest in it. And I think only now do I see that black Americans are more interested in more understanding of reggae. So, I mean, you know, I think that question really depends on the circumstances surrounding the music and the time.
Yeah, okay, let's talk with somebody else here. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm very interested in this idea of the death and rhythm and blues, but I want to offer another suggestion as to why it's happening. Do you think maybe it's directly related to the civil rights era? By that I mean black people, including myself, sort of struggle for integration into larger American society. And the price you pay for integration is cultural assimilation.
Well, see, I don't believe we should have to pay that price.
But I think it's sort of unavoidable. If you, for example, move to a predominantly white neighborhood, I teach at a predominantly white university, my contacts with black culture are very, very rare. Or I have to make great efforts to go to the black community, go back to the East Coast, to keep in touch with what's going on among black people. So what I'm saying is that I'm not saying we shouldn't have integration, surely not. But one of my own theories is that before integration, our culture was stronger. And then with integration and with moving up into middle class, upper class, white suburbs, white corporations, the price you pay is that you suddenly, you lose touches because it's physically impossible sometimes to keep in touch.
Well, that's one of the, you really hit on one of the central theses of the book. In fact, that's one of the things I really talk about at length throughout the book. And I must say, my own position on that is that we must try, and I think what you're doing, the trips back home, the outreach you have to do is really important. Here's an example, and I cite this is an introduction to the book. I interviewed an executive at his office, and we were talking basically about the music business in general. But we started talking about his travels in the business and how he'd lived very well, and his children had lived very well. He went into his office, he had big pictures of Miles Davis and Charlie Parker. He was very much a person who was a big fan of bebop and very much aware of the role of black music in American culture, you know, as a positive force. And yet he was very disheartened and disillusioned that that his children did not share the same affection or did not even seem to have the same understanding. And for some of the reasons you cite, he worked in white corporations, he lived in suburban communities for much of his time, and his children were not reared around the same kind of stimuli that he was. My own position is that you have to try and maintain that. I mean, it's really, I think it's not something that we should say we're going to give up. We should not even allow it to happen. It should be something that we fight constantly to try and keep aware of. I know for a fact that I for example, I could have lived and moved a lot of different places. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And when I finally got my apartment and had a chance to move to Manhattan, to the West Side, which was a much more integrated environment, or stay in Brooklyn in an area which was predominantly black, though it had whites in it, I decided to stay in Brooklyn because I felt that it was important to me as a person to still be around the kinds of people I knew as a child and just to maintain that perspective. It's not an option I don't know that everyone can take, but I think that's my perspective, and that's what the book is about. It's the idea of maintaining perspective. I mean, it's the strangest thing. Since the book came out, I've run into a lot of people from, let's say, Italian and Jewish backgrounds who have come up to me and said that they some of the ideas that I present in the book are very similar to things that they felt about their culture. And I guess I'm just not a fan of the whole idea that American culture has to be homogenized. I don't think that's really good for us. I think that artificially smooths over differences which are important to what made this nation great.
I agree with you 100%, but I just worry that in our strive for integration, I mean, and it's probably a natural phenomenon that every culture eventually becomes eaten up by the dominant culture, and I worry.
Well,
I think it starts with the death of blues music, not just with rhythm and blues.
But the thing I'm saying though is that you're saying it's eaten up. I think that black American culture. I'm sorry, are you still there?
Yeah, I just put her on hold because we were getting a little bit of feedback.
Oh, okay.
She's still listening to
okay.
you.
Okay. Is it that, ironically, and this is an interesting point, is that black American culture is, some people argue, there is a dominant American culture in some ways, in the sense that musically, there's no other indigenous form of American music. Even country music, which is considered a very white style of music, has its roots really in Europe and in a lot of European musical styles that were brought over here by a lot of English settlers. Blues and jazz were purely American forms. A lot of the language that we call American language, I look at commercials all the time, and I see slang words which I used to hear in the black community a year or 2 years ago, which are part of everyday language. So to say that what really happens and what really sort of bothers me is that so often black culture is recycled back to America through whites, and often through English whites, which is very interesting, from the Rolling Stones all the way through George Michael. I think that that's something that we need to be aware of. I think that we need to try and fight that. I don't think that we should accept the idea. I just don't accept the idea that it has to be that way.
Yeah.
And the book is my argument that it doesn't have to be that way.
Let me just get back. I want to see if the caller, like, do you have a final thought or comment that you...
I think I could go on all day about this. It's a fascinating program. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I have
Thank
another...
Thank you for calling.
This is Focus 580, our telephone talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're talking with Nelson George about his recent book, The Death of Rhythm and Blues. You were just making a point there in response to the caller, and I was thinking about how at one point I had on my list of questions that I wanted to ask you about... how many white artists there were who really owe their careers to R&B, and I think as I read your book more and more, I realized the list would be so long, it'd take us forever, and it would include so many artists that you'd almost rather ask the question, how many white artists don't owe their careers to R&B?
Well maybe if you cite Barbara Streisand...
That'd do it, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's the strangest thing. This week, in fact, I went to Radio City Music Hall and I saw Robert Palmer, who's a British singer who's had a number of hit records, and uh-huh. It just amazed me watching the set how much third world, not just R&B, but you know, African music and reggae music was part of his, you know, he had used, and in fact, how many he covered in the course of the show. He did like new interpretations of at least five songs that which were like black audience hits that never really even crossed over to whites. It just blew me. Then I was walking out of the theater and had a picture of Brian Ferry and Steve Winwood, who were coming to play there.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those gentlemen, particularly more Winwood than Brian Ferry, but Ferry definitely is a sort of a... I just saw his last video, and his last video is like a tribute to Josephine Baker, which, you know, blew me away. And Winwood is very much a... I mean, his new record, Roll With It, sounds like Junior Walker and the All-Stars.
Sure.
So this cultural interplay is so extreme. I think one of the things, in fact, that there's another part of the book we haven't discussed in detail, is this idea of... It's not so much even the musical exchange, because I think that that's a natural thing that happens. I think what bothers blacks in America and in the record industry is this idea that they give this music, they co-create stuff, it's utilized by other white artists, and yet the opportunity for them to benefit from it financially is not as great.
You think that's still true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for example, I'll give you a good example. Steve Winwood has Roll With It. Anyone who listens to the music and knows anything about 60s music knows that that record is either Shotgun or any number of Junior Walker. It just is. I mean, the arrangement, the horn, the organ, it sounds so much like Shotgun, it's ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
Yet, a guy like Junior Walker today can't get a record deal, and he still makes the same records. So, someone I know, a guy like Sam Moore, Sam and Dave, can't get a record, who was also recorded and sang in the same style. I mean, they're told their music, they're told by record executives that their music is too old-fashioned, right?
Mm.
And yet, Steve Winwood can do virtually the same record, but because he's white, handsome, hip, and has got a lot of money behind him, can put the same record out and can go to number one. So, I mean, these kind of contradictions in the culture are rife. There's just tons of them. And I think it's very frustrating to the black creative artists. That here's another example of the kind of problems we have in this industry. They have white and black departments in record companies, which basically specialize in marketing music to black audiences or to pop, quote-unquote, audiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you'll find is that you'll find white executives working in the marketing and promotion of black music, along with blacks, very often, in an integrated setting, right? You very, very rarely, and this is, you know, throughout the entire recording industry, you very, very rarely find blacks hired to work in the promotion and merchandising and marketing of white artists, even though the music these white artists may be doing is black-based.
Mm.
So you find these kind of economic inequities, these are the kind of things that motivated me to write the book, because they're like, on the face of it, they're like double standards, which are not based on music, but are based on color.
Well, I've got several people here who'd like to talk with us. In fact, my lines are all full, so let's go back to the phones here and talk with some of these folks who are listening. Next here, we'll go to our line number 2 for our next person. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if we could bring in the civil rights struggle again from the 60s.
Sure.
It seemed like the working class got together in the 60s and was starting to rise up.
Mm-hmm.
But the black element decided to nationalize, you know, to have like their own nationalist movement. I don't know, was that like to instill pride in them? It seemed like they kind of split right there.
Well, there was a strong movement. I mean, and it's something that still goes on, this idea of battle goes on, is that what is the right strategy for black advancement in American society? I'm sort of a mix in my philosophy, and the philosophy that's in the book is that I believe that there's no way in the world that any group in America can succeed without coalescing with other groups. It just is impossible. This is a country of consensus, a country of compromises and working together. On the other hand, I think what happened back in that day, in that era, was that the people who also felt that blacks needed more self-assertion, more control of their destiny, made a very they felt the only way to really do this was to totally break away from the whites who have been working with them in the civil rights movement. I think that was, in my opinion, was too radical a break. I basically agree with the points that these guys are making, right? But I think that it's unrealistic to think that blacks will advance or that real social movement can be made from a minority point of view totally. You know what I'm saying? You have to have unity with like-minded people. I think that, obviously that's the idea behind Jesse's Rainbow Coalition. I think that Jesse sort of he polarizes a lot of people, unfortunately, in a negative way. I think what's going to happen, though, is going to be interesting, you know, on a political sense, is that I think we're going to see a political equivalent of, like, Michael Jackson or Prince. Jesse is, in some sense, like that, but I think we're even going to see someone who's a little more moderate. I don't know. I mean, if Tom Bradley was a little more charismatic, he's pretty boring. Or if someone like a Harold Washington, you know, had been able to grow into his position. William Gray, who's in Congress, I think is a brilliant guy. He was, I think he chaired the budget committee this year.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I think if the caucus wins the nomination, or wins the presidency, excuse me, I think he would be well advised to try and get a guy like William Gray in his cabinet. And so I see that happening. I see that happening. So I see that, you know, and Gray is someone who definitely is very much about trying to help black America. At the same time, he understands that when you help poor people, you're helping all poor people. And I think that that's the kind of thinking that we need more of.
Well, let's talk with somebody else here. Go to the toll-free line. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
First of all, I think the remarks, I forget the name of the black artist that couldn't make it but was selling his songs to others who were white and could. That could be said about Kris Kristofferson or Glenn Campbell or a host of other people. I think that's just a natural progression of being in the career. Just because you're black and good doesn't mean you got to be on top the moment you get out of high school.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that, but you know who Glenn Campbell and Kris Kristofferson are now, don't you?
Well, sure you do now.
Well,
but, I mean, they worked at it, they got it.
Who are the black artists you're referring to?
No, the one that you had mentioned before. I don't.
Well, I didn't mention a black artist who sold
it. You said someone was writing songs and wasn't getting the records out, but there was a white artist that was. And
no, I was saying that Junior. I used Junior Walker and Sam Moore. That's it's a different. What they were complaining about was the fact that guys are using their style and benefiting, and they cannot get any exposure.
Well, also, that's true of anyone. I mean, that could be true of the Kennedys talking about Dukakis. I mean, there's Teddy can't get to be president because of something, and there's Dukakis using the same style.
Dukakis is not anything like Teddy Kennedy. Jesus Christ.
Well, I didn't say anything. No, I just meant that you can make anything. You can turn anything into a black-white issue. And it just seems that, you know, when you make a statement that you're amazed at how much the English language is the result of black America, I think that's so far off the mark.
You don't think that's true?
Well, any linguist will tell you that 40% is French.
No.
25% is German. I mean,
sir, hold on.
I can list all the black words myself, but, you know.
You're making a big leap here. Hold on a second.
Hold on a second.
I was not talking about the roots of American language in the year of the Mayflower. I was talking about 1988.
About
yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. I mean, you know, half of what you said just now has French derivatives, and probably 30-40% has German or Anglian derivatives. It reminds me of...
I think you're missing my point.
Well, let me make just one illustration. 1966, I heard when I was in high school, the Russians invented the color TV, okay? Everyone sort of snickered, the Russians invented the color TV. I mean, this is the result of a society trying to make a name for itself, so they're going to say GE and Zenith have nothing to do with it. We're going to take their thunder. Well, last month I found out that the Russians do have a claim to that. They had one scientist who invented the theory of color TV, but their technology wasn't there. The people weren't supporting it. The government didn't support it. Nothing fell into place. So, yes, you could say the genesis of that idea came, but if we had to wait for the Russians to make good on the deal, we'd still be waiting, whereas GE picked up the ball and off they went. The same thing is true of a lot of things in black artists or white artists. People come up with an idea and somebody else picks up the ball because they've got a different talent. There's nothing wrong about that. It's just, you know, people aren't discriminating because they're doing that. They're just recognizing talent. This guy, whoever are wasting in the background, are getting paid for their work. They should be happy. You know, they're being recognized in their own way. Can't expect everybody just because they have a good idea and they're black and because they're not on top that they're being discriminated against. That's silly.
Well, I never said that, sir.
Well, you imply that. And
Well, you implied that. I made a particular point, and you took it to the point you took it to, and you're very, I think,
I must
right in expressing your opinion.
Let me ask you one thing. I heard you on BEZ. There was a suggestion there that selling out of Motown to white corporate America somehow was a racist act.
No, what are you doing, sir?
Well, I'm saying I heard on WBEZ.
Well, I think you're misinterpreting that statement just as you're misinterpreting what I've said here earlier.
Well, respond to that.
Yeah.
What's?
Yeah, go ahead. We'll say what you're going to say.
No, I mean,
you had made the remark that, or developed the idea that by all of these black radio stations selling out to white America, and the black producers of records, and the mom and pop stores, that somehow there's an implication that white America is taking this away and trying to control the black market in order just to make money. Now, is that not true? Am I misreading you?
I would say that that's more than an implication. I think that there's actual documentation to that fact.
Okay, I don't know the documentation.
So you have to read my book then?
I guess so. Let me ask you one question.
Go ahead.
The people who sold got the money were black.
Yes. Joey Gordy Jr., right.
They sell out. Isn't that the common phrase? They sold out rather than the evil buyers taking it? I mean, if they didn't want to sell, don't sell.
But before you get to the point of selling, you have to also look at the entire industry and what forces them to sell. What pressures are on them that make them less competitive and less able to compete in the marketplace?
Were they going bankrupt?
Well, these are the kind of things that I discuss in the book in great detail. I'm not going to try and synthesize it. I'm just saying this to you. I'm saying that when you look at the structure of the recording industry in America and how it's evolved over, I guess, the last 25 years, you'll see, in general, and this is not just in black music, you see the idea of corporations becoming more and more dominant to the point where they're eating up all the small labels. My beef with that are twofold. One is that it cuts off the diversity of American music because these companies tend to want to make lowest common denominator music. And also because of the nature of the poor health, economic health of black America, it's very, very painful, and also it takes jobs away when black businesses are closed up and bought out.
I got to jump in here, as I just want to remind people we've only got about 10 minutes left, and I've got some other callers, and I want to move on, and I hope that last caller will forgive me if I do that. Also, for people perhaps who have just tuned in, we're talking with Nelson George, who is the author of a new book. It's called The Death of Rhythm and Blues. He writes about music for Billboard magazine, and that's what we're talking about here, black popular music in America.
Can I say something?
Sure.
Well, it's very easy to try and set these things up as all white people are evil and all black people are good. That's not what the book is about, and that's not what I'm arguing about. In fact, in the book I detail some things that I think are very bad that blacks have done to other blacks and done in general in the name of making money. My point, however, is this, that black music is one area where blacks have really been able to really accumulate substantial amounts of capital to make a real impact in the society, and have been allowed to, even in the era of segregation, to compete. I think, as one black executive I know called, he says that black music is to black America, music is to America, as black America as oil is to the Arabs, in the sense that it's a resource, it's a power base. And my argument is just that I think that it's a power base that has been neglected, and I think that, in fact, is being destroyed, and I think it's very. The book is about my reaction to that feeling, and the reaction of other people in the industry to that idea. A great many of the heroes of the book also are white, from Jerry Wexler and Atlantic Records, to many of the great original DJs who helped popularize rhythm and blues in the post-war period were white, and were very much accepted by black America. So I see this as more of an aesthetic, economic argument than a pure racial argument, and I hate to see it trying to portrayed in that way.
Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody else here to line number one for another caller. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Well, plagiarism's been happening with music ever since the beginning of time. Somebody hears a piece and say, hey, I like this one little part, and then they take that little part and just expand it. You know, I've been playing blues for about 20 years, and, you know, I still do first, fourth, and fifth, you know, but I don't play Chicago blues, St. Louis blues. Since I'm from Champaign, Illinois, I play corn blues, you know. but plagiarism's been happening, you know. People borrow from everybody, you know, and if it's exact, I think they should, you know, exact ripoff, they should just take them to court. But then it's awful hard to prove, you know.
Mm.
You know, but, you know, I still use my first, fourth, and fifth, but that doesn't mean I go back and find, you know, a little Walter tune and say, hey, you know, I'm going to just redo this and add some different words to it, you know.
Mm.
You know, I don't know who influenced me or anything. I just know I like it and I play it.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. Let's go on here to somebody else. Line number three, our next person. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. 20 years ago, I was involved in radio in Champaign-Urbana. We played a lot of blues and jazz and even promoted a concert and had Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rockers come down from Chicago.
Hmm.
I would say, back then, there were many stations over the nation that were didn't play off of a playlist of sort of free-form music on FM in particular. You just don't find that anymore. It seems that FM has become what AM used to be.
Exactly.
But the question I wanted to ask Nelson was, what effect does he think MTV has had on blacks? I mean, do blacks watch MTV?
Well, you know, it's funny. They do, like, the ones who have it, you know, because MTV is really not readily available in a lot of, you know, cable's not available in a lot of inner city where the bulk of black America is the big cities, and a lot of them don't see it on a regular basis. It's funny. The only real discussion of video that I have in there is one that it's sort of interesting, and this is something that came to my attention not from black women mostly, which is interesting. They seem to feel that in the videos that are made today, there's an emphasis on the part of the artists and the record companies to try and get on MTV, okay? And so what they feel happens often is that the female, let's say it's a male singer, the female lead in the video tends to be quote-unquote light-skinned or quote-unquote often white. It was something that I wasn't totally aware of until this was pointed out to me, and then I began to look at the videos I got in my office, and they had a very definite point, that there was a definite bias toward, at the very least, a certain style of woman, one that was not dark-skinned, for one thing, even if, you know, and one that tended not to have, quote-unquote, you know, black features, unquote. It just, you know, that's the only thing about videos. Otherwise, videos, you know, in terms of black music, because it is not, there's BET, and there's some other outlets to play videos by black artists, but the thing is that because most of the black communities in America are not wired for cable as of yet, the involvement, the impact of the music video on black music has been not as intense as it has been on let's say, rock and roll and heavy metal.
I wonder, does that get at your question?
Well, I hope it does. I mean, because MTV really has not had a big impact on black artists, other than they don't play very many of them. Because they don't play very many of them, they do sort of, you know, it might have an effect in the fact that it's not played, so it's not seen by a wide audience. But on the other hand, I don't think it's really had an impact on sales one way or the other. We don't know, because it's not there. It's not, black music's not really a deep part of their mix yet. So it's hard to say what impact it's had or not having.
Yeah.
Okay,
let's go on here. Another caller here, line number two, our next person. Hello.
Hello, just a comment on the earlier caller's linguistic statements. As a linguist, black America has had a profound influence upon American English. It's well documented. I would point out the book by Dillard. And such constructions as the U-Haul construction are definitely West African. And the statement that they have had little influence is just ridiculous. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you for the comment. Again, we'll go on to another caller here, back to our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have a short statement. I wonder if your caller
knew that, and I read this recently, that sometime in the past, the society crowd from New York went up to Harlem to hear their music there. That's it. That's all I have to say.
I think that's probably pretty well known that there were, the Cotton Club scene and other sorts of places.
Well, in fact, even today there are parallels to that. Because of integration now, black artists are much more welcome downtown. In the era they weren't. But, I mean, what you see now is that you'll go to a very hip club, which is the equivalent, I guess, of that society crowd, a place called Nell's, which is a big hip club in Manhattan, right? And you go in there, and it'll be mostly very rich white kids, a lot of them, kids, college kids, Europeans, and they'll be listening to rap music for, wall-to-wall rap music, for hours on end. And I think in some ways that's an equivalent. So there's always that that idea that whites have always been attracted to black music on some level because it was different from what they heard or sort of rebellious from what they, were exposed to in their homes, has always been there, and I guess it'll be there for a while longer, too.
We're almost at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I'm sorry, I got one caller here that we're not going to be able to take. Just as a way of wrapping up, do you feel like, you say in the book, you feel like that there has been something in black music and perhaps in black culture, too, that has been lost and that you're afraid that that you're never going to be able to get it back. Do you really think it's that bad?
I think that I'm actually more positive in the, now that maybe things can be, I don't know, reverse. I just want more balance. I think that it's going to be hard. It's never going to be 1965 again or 1971, which I think were great, great years for black American music. I do think, however, that we see there's many examples. I mean, I cite Anita Baker because she's a very obvious example, and she's, so people like her. Her success, in fact, has had a great impact on other companies to sign artists who have a similar style. I think also that Whitney Houston's going to be interesting to see because Whitney's become so big, and she's had a lot of criticism from black Americans about not her success, but the way some of her musical choices. I think we think that she's a great singer, but I also think that many complain about her music, and they feel it's a little too bland, and it doesn't have a kind of fire that she's capable of. And I'm hoping that on her third album, now that she's so successful, that she will be more willing to be a little more adventurous, to take some more chances in her music, and to expose, from the platform she has now, America to another style of singing. I mean, I think, Whitney Houston could be Aretha Franklin if she wanted to. And I'd love to see her do more material in that style, because I think she would succeed with that as well.
Yeah. Well, it's been good talking with you. I appreciate you spending the time with us.
Well, thank you for having me. The call was real interesting. I really had a good time.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
Thanks.
To tell you just once more, you folks who are listening, if you are interested in reading some more on this topic, look for the book, The Death of Rhythm and Blues. Nelson George is the author. He writes about music for Billboard magazine and has two other books as well, one about Michael Jackson called The Michael Jackson Story and also A History of Motown, Where Did Our Love Go? And his current book, Death of Rhythm and Blues, is published by Pantheon.